Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, WikiLeaks has leaked a draft chapter of the secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. The chapter, addressing intellectual property rights, shows a favoring of corporations over the public, say critics. What do the corporate lobbyists and government negotiators have in mind for us? We'll talk with Peter Mabarduk of Public Citizen. Also on Counterspin today, the monster storm that struck the Philippines has killed thousands and left hundreds of thousands homeless. This happened right before international climate change talks were getting underway. But are media making the connection between climate change and the catastrophe? We'll talk to Ann Peterman of the Global Justice Ecology Project. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Nuclear negotiations between Iran and the U.S. and other countries seemed to hit a bump in the road late last week. That was enough for the issue to make it to the Sunday chat shows. But who was invited to the table? CBS Face the Nation sought a familiar face, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who, as usual, slammed any diplomatic progress as capitulation to Iran. That segment was followed by former Pentagon and CIA Director Leon Panetta, who warned that Iran was a terrorist-supporting nation that couldn't be trusted. On Meet the Press and on ABC's This Week, viewers heard from U.S. politicians who are supporting a plan to increase sanctions on Iran right now. Overall, it was hawks, hawks, and more hawks, pushing the idea that we should be skeptical about peaceful negotiations, keeping economic and possibly military warfare on the agenda.
Time magazine has caused a stir with its cover on New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. The elephant in the room tagline was seen by some as a comment on Christie's weight. But there's real problems with media coverage of Christie. Since his big re-election win, pundits have largely ignored his views and first-term performance in favor of fawning speculation about his presidential prospects. Like Time's Mark Halperin on Meet the Press.
Chris Christie is someone who is magical in the way politicians could be magical, like our last three presidents. People like having them on TV. He's a good talker. He won.
The Time cover story heaped on praise, too. Christie had run the Garden State with combustible passion, blunt talk, and the kind of bipartisan deal-making that no one seems to do anymore. Christie's problem, these accounts stress, is that he might not be conservative enough for the party's Tea Party activists. As the Time story put it, Christie, quote, opposes gay marriage, but called off a legal fight to block it, causing Christian conservatives to question his reliability, close quote. A fair assessment would point out that Christie had single-handedly blocked marriage equality before finally throwing in the towel, that Christie's politics slant pretty uniformly to the right, and he didn't deliver on many of his campaign promises. As a rare critical analysis in the New York Times pointed out, Christie has resorted to the same budget gimmicks that he used to criticize Democrats for. Spending has gone up on his watch, and the state's job creation numbers are dismal. But these actual issues remain largely off the corporate media radar as they lavish praise on the supposedly straight-talking bipartisan Republican governor. That's the real elephant in the room.
There was a pretty remarkable retraction by the CBS show 60 Minutes. On November 10th, correspondent Lara Logan told viewers that they had concluded they were misled by a security contractor who told them he had personally witnessed the 2012 attack on a diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya. It turns out the witness, according to other documents that surfaced after the 60 Minutes segment aired, was actually not there at all. CBS defended its report at first until finally issuing the correction and removing the broadcast from its website. But anyone listening to the source's story should have been suspicious. He told CBS he secretly snuck into the compound during the assault. When he was spotted by one of the attackers, he smashed this person in the face with a rifle butt. He also claimed to have snuck into an Al-Qaeda-controlled hospital. There was no face smashing there, but still a rather dramatic and perhaps unbelievable tale, which it was. And you didn't need any special documents to be skeptical of his story. So why was CBS hoaxed? They were chasing a Benghazi story. This has been a major issue on the right. They talk about a White House cover-up over Benghazi, though it's never been clear what conservatives think they're going to uncover in all of this. And Logan's never been shy about her hawkishness. She gave a speech after the Benghazi attack calling for a U.S. military response. So this may have been less about being conned by a clever source and more about wanting to tell a story they shouldn't have believed in the first place.
The Washington Post's Richard Cohen was discussing Chris Christie's Tea Party problems in a November 11th column when all racist hell broke loose. After writing that today's GOP is not racist, but is deeply troubled about things, including race, Cohen declared, quote, "People with conventional views must repress a gag reflex when considering the mayor-elect of New York, a white man married to a black woman and with two biracial children," close quote. Cohen ended the paragraph writing, quote, "To cultural conservatives, this doesn't look like their country at all," close quote. Describing such gagging as a conventional view is odd, even if Cohen seems to be ascribing that view to cultural conservatives. But remembering how Cohen began the misbegotten paragraph, by declaring that the GOP, a party dominated by such cultural conservatives, is not racist, reveals the larger problem. Cohen reacted to outrage over the column by claiming that it was all a misunderstanding and suggesting critics were taking him out of context. But the context seemed clear to Cohen's editor, Fred Hyatt, who belatedly acknowledged that he should have changed the wording before publication. And Cohen has a history of writing racist things. In July, he said he was sorry that Trayvon Martin had been gunned down, but that he was wearing a uniform we all recognize. In 1986, the Post apologized for a Cohen column defending jewelers who refused to allow black men into their stores. If Cohen's columns aren't racist, just accidents of misunderstanding, how come he never writes a column that's accidentally misunderstood as brimming with tolerance and the milk of human understanding?
And finally, when a country reaches the status of official enemy, you can expect a lot of bad press in the United States. But there's also some downright weird press, too. The New York Times took a look at Venezuela on November 7th in a story about how the country sets unrealistic standards for female beauty. This can be seen in some store mannequins, quote, "a bulging bosom and cantilevered buttocks, a wasp waist and long legs, a fiberglass fantasy, Venezuelan style," close quote. Now, that doesn't sound like a uniquely Venezuelan phenomenon, but the story is really about how Venezuelan women are getting plastic surgery to try and look like these mannequins. As the paper puts it, cosmetic procedures are so fashionable here that a woman with implants is often casually referred to as an operated woman. And then the Times zeroes in on the political irony. Quote, "The embrace of plastic surgery clashes with the government's socialist ideology and frequent talk of creating a society free of the taint of commercialism," close quote. The Times also references the country's culture of easy money and consumerism, as well as the penchant for the quick fix and instant gratification. So in addition to all of the other terrible things the New York Times has told you over the years about Venezuela, it's also a place where pressure on women to attain a basically unattainable beauty standard leads many of them to undergo surgery in order to meet the demands of their culture. Except, well, when the Times says this, somewhat near the end of the piece, quote, "The little data available indicates that Venezuelan women do not get plastic surgery more than their counterparts in many other countries," close quote. Well, okay. So what was the point here again?
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Typhoon Haiyan has devastated the Philippines. Thousands are feared dead. Over 500,000 are believed to be homeless. Getting aid to those who have survived is proving to be remarkably challenging. The disaster struck right before delegates from around the world arrived in Warsaw for an international climate conference. But our media accounts of the disaster in the Philippines, some of them very dramatic, moving, even poignant. Are they making the proper connection to climate change and to climate justice? Joining us now to talk about this is Ann Peterman. She's executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project. Ann Peterman, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, I want to start by talking about this link, because a lot of the coverage I've found remains somewhat agnostic, I guess you could say, about drawing a line between this particular event, this storm, and climate change. It's sort of, you know, scientists warn us not to jump to any conclusions based on one event kind of thing. What's your response to that framing of this issue, the idea that, yes, climate change is most certainly real, it's most certainly happening, but we can't say it, quote unquote, caused this particular storm?
Yeah, I keep hearing the scientists say that there isn't a definitive connection between climate change and this particular storm. They said the same thing about Superstorm Sandy and so forth. But clearly we're seeing a trajectory of storms around the world becoming much, much worse than they ever have been before. You know, these so-called 100-year storms are happening now, not just yearly, but several times a year. We have, you know, tremendous droughts and wildfires and hurricanes and so on. And obviously, there's a correlation between these storms getting stronger and climate change. So maybe they can't directly say that Hurricane Haiyan was caused by climate change, but certainly it's part of a trend of storms growing far worse because of climate change.
And it's curious because, you know, as a non-scientist, I don't look at this and pretend to know more than a climate scientist does, but there is never going to be a hurricane that arrives with made by climate change stamped onto it. I think there's an understanding that we're living in the world we're living in. I want you to talk a little bit about the concept of climate justice. People know climate change, they know global warming. Climate justice is an idea that kind of expands our understanding of this phenomenon. What does it mean?
Climate justice, well, it's a term that's been taken over by a lot of groups for their own means, but originally the term climate justice was devised by many of the organizations representing communities on the front lines of climate change. So in other words, communities already experiencing the impacts of climate change who are pointing out that climate justice means that their needs need to be taken into account when we're looking at what needs to happen to deal with climate change. And it can't merely be action on climate change, because action on climate change can include geoengineering and all kinds of really bad ideas, that it has to be just things that are very just in their nature. So when we're looking at what we're going to do about climate change, taking into account the impacts on the communities that are already being affected by climate change, on, let's say, the workers who are in the industries that need to be transitioned to something else, on indigenous people who are living on the lands that are some of the last intact, let's say, forests on the planet, that all of these different pieces have to be taken into account and have to be dealt with justly. We can't just say we need climate action. The climate action that we take has to be very thoughtful and very sensible and very fair. The Philippines has many organizations that have been going to these UN climate conferences, that have been having meetings with other organizations throughout Asia and throughout the world to look at what can be done in a fair and just way to deal with climate change. And very often those kinds of things are coming from the grassroots, are coming from the bottom up. What are the things that people are already doing that are actually good for the climate that we could promote more of? And what are the things that are happening from the top down that we need to say no to? For example, these UN climate conferences that get absolutely nothing done.
I want to ask you about that, because this storm happened right as delegates are heading to the conference. And these conferences, along with sort of the day that the IPCC report comes out, suddenly climate change is in the news. There's some substantial coverage. The conferences are criticized quite often for failing to arrive at any concrete solutions. Is it fair to say that nothing happens at these conferences? As I understand it, there's a lot of activism and a lot of citizen activism that is present, maybe not inside the rooms where negotiations are happening, but around the conferences themselves.
Exactly. And yeah, a lot of people have become totally disenchanted with the official process over the years. We started going to the UN climate conferences in 2004, And at that point, there were just a handful of climate justice groups that were going to them. And then they blossomed around the Copenhagen Climate Summit, which was where the world leaders were supposed to come together and come up with the new set of commitments that would take effect once the commitments under the existing Kyoto Protocol expired in 2012. So in 2009, they were supposed to come up with the agreement for what would take place after 2012. And they didn't come up with anything inside the room. You know, Obama had his secretly negotiated Copenhagen Accord that he waltzed out at the last minute. Even people in the media room where I was at that time were booing him. People were so disgusted at the fact that, you know, everybody had been negotiating for these 2 weeks, and all of a sudden here's this brand new thing that nobody's seen before being put in front of all the ministers to decide on. So at the same time that that was going on, there were climate justice groups that had been meeting for about 2 years under the umbrella of a new thing called Climate Justice Action. And they organized, and I was part of that, our organization was part of that, organized a simultaneous march out of the conference center of all of the NGOs and indigenous peoples organizations. Bolivia was a part of it. Many of the countries that were totally disgusted were a part of it. And at the same time, people who were not accredited, who were not allowed in, were marching toward the conference center from the outside. And the idea was that they would meet at the fence and have what they called, what we all called a people's assembly of people talking about what are the real solutions and what will they look like. Unfortunately, the Danish police got in the way and beat back the delegates who were trying to get to the fence and beat back the people who were marching to the fence from the outside very violently. And so that didn't happen. But it was an amazing thing to see all of these organizations coming together and saying, you know what, this process is bogus, this process is corrupt, and we need something else. And after that happened, actually, all of the organizations, the NGOs, were banned from coming back in. Anybody who had participated in that march out was not allowed back in, and the last day inside was like a ghost town. There were no booths, no NGO booths in there, and it was quite eerie.
But it is suggestive of the idea that radical action is what's needed to do something about this crisis.
Well, sure, and in the same way that the WTO was largely derailed by a global justice movement that was happening, rising up all over the world. Anytime WTO delegates met, you know, they were met on the outside by radical action, culminating, of course, with what happened in Seattle when the whole meeting was actually shut down. That's the kind of thing that really needs to happen at these climate conventions, is for people to say, you know what, you've had your chance, you've done nothing, it's time for you to get out of the way so that we, as the people who are really being affected, can figure out how to deal with this.
We've been speaking with Ann Peterman of the Global Justice Ecology Project. You can find them online at globaljusticeecology.org. Ann Peterman, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
On November 13th, WikiLeaks released a leaked chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The TPP is a secretly negotiated so-called free trade agreement. The new information is the draft of the TPP's chapter dealing with intellectual property. According to WikiLeaks spokesperson Julian Assange, quote, if instituted, the TPP's intellectual property regime would trample over individual rights and free expression, as well as ride roughshod over the intellectual and creative commons. If you read, write, publish, think, listen, dance, sing, or invent, if you farm or consume food, if you're ill now or might one day be ill, the TPP has you in its crosshairs, close quote. The group Public Citizen has been on the TPP story from the beginning. We are joined by Peter Maybarduk, Director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines Program. Welcome to Counterspin, Peter Maybarduk.
It's good to be here.
Well, speaking generally about the draft chapter, do you think Julian Assange is right? And could you describe some of the ways these policies, if implemented, would affect people where they live?
I do think he's right. What's really at stake here is it's two very different visions of the world, one in which knowledge and information is closed off, controlled by companies via exclusive rights systems, monopolized, and we rely on them to essentially steward the public interest. The other vision is much more open vision, in which we collaborate and build on each other's knowledge and promote access to knowledge and knowledge goods. And this is tremendously important because it affects many aspects of our daily lives. It affects our freedom online. There are proposals in the agreement that would take creative and cultural works out of the public domain for a longer period of time, that would force internet service providers to act as copyright enforcers on online, take down a lot of content that is in fact free speech, that is in fact satire or parody of copyrighted materials. There are issues of plant and animal patents. The United States government is trying to force other countries to broadly patent and promote the exclusive ownership of plant varieties and animals, and so these different sort of gene patent issues. You know, the issue I work on of healthcare, access to medicines, access to affordable healthcare is an issue that could really be affected by this agreement.
Well, I'd like to get to that now. It's hard to imagine anything more important than healthcare. You're the director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines Program. How would the TPP, if this draft were put in place, affect healthcare specifically?
You were correct to call it a so-called trade agreement. What we really have here is a secret rulemaking against public health. Worldwide access to medicines depends in no small part on countries being able to obtain generics, either locally manufactured or imported from India. This keeps costs down for cancer, HIV/AIDS. And HIV/AIDS, for example, globally, we've been able to save about 10 million lives worldwide since 2000 due to generic competition. It would have been completely impossible if the brand name companies had been allowed to continue to dominate and monopolize that field. And that's precisely what's at stake in the TPP. This is the U.S. government, due to the lobbying and political influence of Big Pharma, advancing a number of proposals to expand patent monopolies and take medicines out of the public domain, make the periods for which medicines on which we all depend are monopolized longer. And it's principally about taking the current state of the U.S. rules, which are dominated by this lobby, and imposing them on developing countries, where it's completely the difference between life and death for a great many people. But it's also the case that some of these rules, and especially one rule that we're expecting the United States to advance very soon in this negotiation, would actually bind U.S. consumers, would actually bind Americans to bad systems that we have now, which we are trying to undo. So, for example, a very unfortunate rule was advanced in Obamacare, which monopolizes new cancer drugs for 12 years. These treatments cost $10, $20, $30, $100,000 a year. We all know people who have suffered and struggled and had real troubles with their household budgets trying to find a way to pay for cancer medications. Now, the White House, for the past couple of years, has presented a budget that seeks to reduce that monopoly period so that we can have affordable biosimilars, what they're called. So this is billions of dollars per year at stake, and you know, Americans' budgets and Americans' ability to deal with cancer and heart disease and other illnesses. So publicly, the administration has said it's trying to change this rule. It's trying to peel back the monopolies. But in this trade negotiation, the United States is going to advance a proposal which would actually lock us in to the 12-year period. Once we've signed the TPP with a 12-year period in it, we'd be bound by that. We wouldn't be able to undo. We'd lose our congressional ability to overturn the bad rule. So secretly, behind closed doors, the Obama administration is doing very different things with regard to health care than their stated public commitments. Rather than promoting global health and rather than trying to reduce costs at home, we're smashing global health. We're very aggressively trying to bully countries into accepting measures that would lead to preventable suffering and death. And we're giving away the store to Big Pharma here in the United States, too.
The Washington Post reported on the draft chapter on November 13th, focusing on how opposition to TPP has brought together unlikely allies, including the Tea Party on one hand and Public Citizen and a high-toned gaggle of PhD economists on the other. So the word seems to be getting out, right? I mean, there has been some coverage.
I think this is a very good week for us, and we need to capitalize on it. These agreements are negotiated behind closed doors. There's incredibly little public access. You can't sit on the negotiation. You can't see the text. Members of Congress can't see the text. And because there are so many aggressive pro-corporate proposals in it and so many objectionable ideas, these agreements depend on that secrecy in order to pass. And the U.S. Trade Representative is rather open about that fact, that they need the secrecy in order to successfully negotiate and be able to get these ideas through. And so when we have moments like this where there's public attention, it's very important to advance that. Prior agreements have failed once they come into the spotlight.
I can't help but remember the leaked TPP material that Public Citizen was publicizing more than a year ago. And there was very little media interest then. My guess is that the fact that the Tea Party, a media darling, has joined the opposition has probably given the story more legs this time around. Well, ironically, the New York Times published an editorial a week before this recent leak in which it stated, quote, a good agreement would lower duties and trade barriers on most products and services, strengthen labor and environmental protections, limit the ability of governments to tilt the playing field in favor of state-owned firms, and balance the interests of consumers and creators of intellectual property, close quote. Why would anyone expect an agreement like the New York Times describes to come out of a highly secretive process that includes corporate lobbyists and basically excludes public interest advocates?
You know, it was very funny. The James Levin, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and others called the New York Times to account for that, pointing out that how can the New York Times endorse an agreement that it has not read? And that was in the public editor's blog yesterday, trying to deal with that question. And they asked the editorial board director, who said, well, we supported the idea of an agreement, not any particular proposal or secret text, really tried to split hairs and dodge the question a bit.
We've been speaking with Peter May Barduke, director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines program. You can see Public Citizen's work on the TPP and everything else at citizen.org. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Peter May Barduke.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. Go to FAIR.org for more information. That's also where you can listen to Counterspin and subscribe to the Counterspin podcast. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.